This is Fresh Air. Religions in America have learned a lot from advertising and pop culture. We have religious bumper stickers, ashtrays, TV and radio programs, pop records, and theme parks. The marketing of American religion is the subject of the new book, Selling God, by Lawrence Moore. He's a professor of history at Cornell University. He told me why he's studying religion.
I grew up in Texas. I grew up around religion. I kind of cut my intellectual teeth arguing and debating about religion. I didn't come from a very political family. We didn't argue about politics. My parents didn't reveal how they voted. They thought that was inappropriate. So religion was the subject. And religion was the really important thing. And at a certain point, I suppose, I argued myself out of religion altogether. But the interest of why this is so important in American culture and society. And my general notion is that, okay, religion is a form of organized worship. And we all understand that. It's a way that people come together to worship God. But religion in this culture is so much more than that. It is a diversion. It is a kind of socialization process. It is a social marker to help people in this very pluralistic society identify themselves. It is a way of thinking about politics. It is a vocabulary for politics. We all know that. So that it's just an incredible kind of resource out there.
Well, your new book, Selling God, focuses on the commercialization of some aspects of religion, the marketing of religion, the advertising, the merchandising. Where do you see it starting?
Well, if you took a really long look, I mean, you know, that the notion that religion could be marketed had occurred to Christ. It had occurred to Martin Luther. It is not something that begins with the American story. But for me, it becomes incredibly important in the 19th century because prior to that in this country, that religion had a kind of monopoly on what I would call cultural material. That is, it was which was primarily print material. Preachers were the orators of our society, and they were the authors of our society. And what was disseminated in print form was not exclusively, but largely religious material. In the 19th century, there is an incredible diversification of other things, of different kinds of print material, and then other kinds of entertainments that had not been much around in the colonial period. The theater, various kinds of professional sports. So the market for cultural commodities, if you like, those things we do to improve ourselves or to entertain ourselves, really takes off in the 19th century. Technology makes it possible.
Describe for us what a 19th century revival meeting might have been like and how that fits into the history that you're describing.
Well, I think the important thing about the general shape of 19th century revivals, and they're not nearly, on average, as wild and as tumultuous as we sometimes get depictions of them in the very beginning. In fact, they become fairly early in the 19th, rather well-staged events, well-planned events, so that the seating arrangements are set out very carefully, the speaker's platform, rules for how to behave, the emphasis on good order to get the maximum effect. But they are almost, why they are different than, or different from other kinds of religious meetings is they're almost always outdoors so that they can bring together large numbers of people. They last over a period of time. A revival meeting can last a week, and as they become a kind of general summer camp meeting, they can go on for a month. And you know, you have to bring people together to do something. So obviously there's more going on in a revival meeting than sermons and prayers.
How did the style of oratory change with the revival meeting?
Well, a revivalist has to get people's attention. In the bluntest terms, if you look at many of the styles of colonial ministers or ministers whose sinecure is there because it's fixed, they can preach in a certain manner. They have a captive audience for 2 hours. They can be learned. They can expect a high level of sophistication on the part of the people who hear them. They are not emotional. They can be very dry. The revival preacher is emotional. The revival preacher is like an actor, and that is explicit. You know, Protestants were, in the early part of the 19th century, were by and large enemies of the theater. Whitfield, Finney, other great 19th century American revivalists didn't like theater. But they all said that we have in the pulpit to learn the ways of the actor, because otherwise people will be going to the theater and not coming to the church.
I'm interested in that point that you made, that a lot of the revivalists didn't like the idea of theater, that they thought theater was a kind of dangerous, sinful form of entertainment.
It's a lie. It's a fake.
It's a fake. Okay. Yeah, but they felt that they should learn from theater and bring some of those techniques to their own preaching.
They should learn, but they shouldn't become fakes. Mm-hmm. Their terrible fear, and of course this was the charge, this is what's going back and forth. The revivalist says, in effect, I can do this because God is behind what I do. I am not a fake. And I don't change my role every night. I don't play Hamlet this night and Iago the next night. I am always what I am, doing God's work. But from the standpoint of the critics of the revival, that the revivalist was just like an actor, dissembling all the time.
My guest is Lawrence Moore. He's the author of the new book, Selling God, American Religion in the Marketplace of Culture. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lawrence Moore, author of the new book, Selling God. He's a professor of history at Cornell University. Would it be fair to jump ahead to the 20th century and see if there were any comparisons between the revival meetings and the evangelists who preached so effectively on radio and television?
Well, sure, I think it's fair because, I mean, the only difference is that it's now radio and television, that you can use a different kind of medium to reach large audiences.
Where does preaching on radio begin?
In the 20s. The first radio broadcast, this is before network radio, of course, but the first broadcast sermon on anything like a real station was out of Pittsburgh. And it was not an evangelical fundamentalist. I mean, the more liberal Protestants, the more respectable Protestants, if you like, I'm very nervous using that designation, but people who understood, you know, that they were educated and they were they sort of represented a non-divisive kind of theological message. They were the ones who did most of the preaching, and that was certainly true once networks got established. Both radio and television.
When the networks were established, what were their policies about religion on the air?
They would not sell religious times. At least CBS and NBC would not sell time to religion. They would give it away, but they would give it away using the advice of leading Catholic, Jewish, and Protestant organizations, which excluded a lot of what we might call fundamentalist evangelical types. When NBC, the old NBC radio station, was founded, they were in desperate shape for advertisers. So they were willing to sell, at least for a time, radio time.
So the network idea was to use religious programming as a public service and to keep it as much in the mainstream as possible and as ecumenical.
Ecumenical, non-divisive, ennobling, respectable, all those words.
These are the words they would use.
Yes.
So where did the evangelists find their way into broadcasting?
Well, they found it through local stations who had dead time where they couldn't get advertisers, so they would be willing to sell time. These were the local stations. They had a certain amount of flexible time. That this was paid time for them. They didn't have to worry about whether anybody was listening to it or not. They didn't care. And, of course, some of these people could set up their own stations. The Moody Bible Institute could set up a station. They got very good at it because they were the ones who had to compete for an audience. The sort of established face they had, their time was free. They had a kind of audience. They didn't have to worry about it. It was there. So one of the reasons I think that when television came along, and what you see right now is that the evangelical groups really were the ones who learned best how to do media, to make it a kind of entertaining program. The other things looked very staid, and they were around in the 50s, but disappeared soon thereafter.
Yeah, you make the point in your book that the National Council of Churches, which got a lot of the public service airtime on the networks, almost had a policy against preaching. They would do, like, dramas and, I guess, discussion shows and things along those lines?
They would do panels. They would do drama. Preaching seemed, for television, their notion was that when television came along, preaching wasn't enough. They were thinking, trying to think innovatively about programming.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain degree, they were successful, but they weren't as good at it, as it turned out, as what we see on television right now. And televangelism is still very powerful and strong, and it's built around preaching.
In 1960, the FCC ruled that radio and TV didn't have to give time to religious groups for public service.
Right.
How did that change the scene for religious programming on television and radio?
Well, by that time, I think something else had happened. There were so many now possibilities of independent stations that, in fact, what many religious leaders, Pat Robertson, Baker, Falwell, did was simply fund their own religious networks and give up on NBC and ABC.
Who do you consider some of the TV preachers who basically, like, defined the form?
Oral Roberts and Jimmy Swaggart.
Why did you choose those two?
Because they were the first, because in some ways they were the best at just proving that preaching and emotional preaching was enough to win a large audience of devoted followers. They were taking what had been going on in revival tents and putting it on television in a way that worked to reach large audiences. That's why, to me, they were sort of central to the early story of evangelists on television.
It's funny, in the late 50s and early 60s, I used to watch Oral Roberts, and I'd never seen anything like it in my life. I was a Jewish girl in an apartment building in Brooklyn, New York, and I'd never seen a tent revival like this. And I'd never seen faith healing before. And it was just, it was captivating to me. I mean, it was fascinating.
Well, most people hadn't, even Protestants, even Christians, had not seen that kind of activity on television, that it had been a kind of tent show, and most people don't go to tent shows.
You spend a lot of time in Lancaster,
right.
Pennsylvania,
yeah,
for family reasons, and that's the area right around what's called Amish country.
Yes.
Now, the Amish are a group that have resisted all of the manifestations of modern culture. So do you think that they've completely resisted the marketing of religion?
Well, I make the point that if you aren't going to market your religion, somebody's going to do it for you. And what's happened to the Amish in Lancaster County is that they have become a major tourist attraction and advertised as such. It is a tourist draw. It is a way to come to Lancaster, see the Amish, spend your money, visit the Amish farm, visit the Amish restaurant, and shop at all the second stores that line Route 30 flowing east out of Lancaster. So it's a kind of, I guess, final irony that as you resist commercialization, you wind up being a major target of commercial forces that... It's not the Amish that are doing this, but it's just a way of demonstrating just how large and devouring this phenomenon is. It hasn't destroyed the Amish way of life yet.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Lawrence Moore is the author of Selling God, American Religion in the Marketplace of Culture. He's a professor of history at Cornell University. This is Fresh Air.